Can you hear me okay in the back? I'm going to get a lot louder, but as long as we're good. Okay, good. Special welcome to the folks tuning in online. I want to make sure to recognize them. I'd love to hear your questions and feedback, so if you're watching this virtually, welcome. And welcome everyone in the room. My name's Kyle Bone. I'm the Director of Informatics at Purdue University. For those of you I haven't had a chance to meet yet, I'm a really warm and fuzzy guy, so I'd love to hear your questions at pretty much any time you have them. But you know, something you probably don't know about me is that I love road trips. Yeah. Now, I don't mean those road trips that you took in college that maybe you don't quite remember. I mean the road trips you took with your parents that you wish you didn't remember. These were the trips where you ride in the back seat of the family car with your brother or sister battling for control of the line. We all know the line. It's that seam that runs down the middle of the back seat, creating a no-fly zone separating two halves of the car. Many a battle has been waged over the line. Now, my parents, in an effort to draw a truce between my sister and I, they invested in travel board games. You see, the idea here is simple. You take a regular-sized game, and then you shrink it down until it's not really fun anymore. If you thought Monopoly was frustrating before, wait until you're playing it with a pair of tweezers. And Connect 4 travels well enough, but the pieces are so small, we were losing them all the time. And after a while, we're playing Connect 3, and let's just face it, that's tic-tac-toe. Right? See, we have the same challenge as we make our move to mobile. We take all of these things that we used to do, and then we shrink them down and put them onto a smaller screen. But the thing is if we weren't entirely thrilled with what we had before, is making it smaller, making it better, right? Or are we just introducing a new series of problems? You see, the idea of education isn't all that different than what we used to have, right? We used to have guys wearing togas standing in front of white columns. Gutenberg comes along with his press. Now I can listen to the guy in the toga, or I can just buy his book, right? I've got options now. This is what we're seeing. It's the same basic idea. Many of us still have the columns. The togas are worn in entirely different places now, right? But they're still there. So we can listen to the guy, the person. We just buy their book, right? These are our options. Here's the thing. As we've made this move, though, we've adopted new technology. And what we've tried to do is transition these things we had before, the book, and we just made it electronic. Let me tell you something I recently learned about ebooks. It turns out they're a lot like books. I know. Who would have thought? I mean, they're not exactly the same, are they? I mean, there's more than a nuanced difference between books and ebooks. For example, I can't put ebooks on my shelves, right? People will think that I cannot read, that I have no knowledge, because I have no shelves full of books. The other problem ebooks have is that they have no cover, no outward cover anyway. It used to be that you could go into a public place like a coffee house or a bookstore and you could see someone reading a book, but now with an e-reader, we have no idea what they're reading, which is unfortunate because this takes away probably the best pickup line for awkward guys everywhere, right? It's disappointing. But you know the greatest difference between books and e-books? Is that ebooks don't have that signature book smell, right? You know the smell I'm talking about? That combination of cotton fiber and industrial ink. It's playful, but not too ostentatious. It's got a bit of a woodsy after smell, right? The question is, why would we want ebooks to be like books? We have far more capable devices now. It seems to me that this is the least imaginative thing we could have done with the technology. We are using a horse to pull our car, right? That's functionally what an ebook does. At the end of the day, they're just books. Why? Why do we want them to be like books? Heck, we even make them, we give them page-turning animation. Is that designed to make it feel like a more book-like experience, or does that just waste my time as I wait for this animation to turn pages? Was that progress? Why am I fixed to a rectangle? Right, a fixed-size rectangle cookie cutter pressed over and over and over again. Why is it that way? We have already solved these problems. We have solved these problems a million times over, but yet they are the fundamentals of an ebook. Right? So the question becomes, how do we get beyond ebooks? How do we move beyond this idea of what a book should be? Why do we even still call them books? For example, it's time to move on. It's time to think about how it looks differently. And we can start by using the technology that students already have. And we can create better experiences. We can deliver learning in the places where they're already at, where they already lived their lives, both socially and academically. And we can take advantage of the technology they have on them, the tools in their pockets and their backpacks. Right? Idea of the cone of distraction. The idea of the cone of distraction says that a student sitting in the front of their class with their laptop open creates a cone-shaped area of distracted students behind them. We have one right here, actually. This gentleman, what's your name? Eric here is creating a cone of distraction, so the table sitting behind him has not been listening this entire time. Now, you can actually calculate the cone of distraction, where radius 1 is the screen diagonal of your laptop, and radius 2 is what we call the probability of PowerPoint, meaning the more boring your PowerPoint slides are, the wider that cone gets. Hopefully mine's fairly narrow and just limited to that table, but we won't rule out the rest of the room. Okay? This is the problem. We begin to see these new challenges emerge, but what begins to happen is we move to mobile devices, tablets, phones, our cone shrinks or is eliminated entirely. If we begin to adopt and leverage the tools that are already in place, we can begin to rethink how the technology is delivered, how content and information is delivered. But more than that, we can use its very presentation as a new way to inspire collaboration. We had a focus group recently with a group of students, and we talked to them about what are the tools that you use when we're not looking, right? We have learning tools like the learning management system. We kind of lead you to use those. What are the ones that you use that we don't know about? And the interesting thing about students is that they're a lot like those toys from Toy Story, that they just come to life when you're not watching. And we learned a lot about how they use the technology around them, but what we learned the most about was Facebook. Now, it was no surprise. We knew going into it that Facebook was a big part of their lives, but we didn't know the half of it. It was interesting as we talked to them more. If it were possible to turn off the entire rest of the internet and just leave Facebook running, they might be okay with that for a little while. Well, we found that social media was a core element of life, earth, wind, and Facebook, right? This is how they operated. So if we're going to move beyond an ebook, it has to be not only delivered locally, but it has to be social. We have to connect them in environments where they're already at. Not by creating new destinations, but by leveraging what they're already doing. Now, in doing so, another thing we have to look at is how do we deliver to the device? Right? What is that tool? We published an ECAR research bulletin recently about a study we did at Purdue to learn a lot more about students and their preferences and uses of mobile apps. And how do they think about them? How do they use them as part of their regular lives? And we learned a ton. But the one thing we learned was that they had a strong preference towards consuming native apps. So when given the choice between consuming a native app on their device and using the browser on the same device, they would choose to consume the native app in almost every category except for one, and it broke even, and that was internet search. The reason was because 70% said they were just easier to use. 70% said they were just faster. Wouldn't you want to if they were easier to use and faster? But then when we dove down and looked at, okay, how would you want to read on your device? How would you want to access your textbook? Half wanted to consume them from a mobile app. Only a quarter wanted to get them from their browser. Right? Faster, easier to use. We can begin to leverage the capability of the devices that they're already owning, already bringing into the classroom with them. That's the exciting part of this. Nobody asked them to do it. For the first time since the calculator watch, computing is fashionable. Right? You can put your little pink thing on there and slide it in your pocket. They're doing it already, and we can take advantage of this. And so what we can begin to look at is a hybridized model. Mobile plus web. In that order. Right? How do we deliver to the mobile device? And when I say mobile device, I'm thinking of a very broad application of that to include tablets. But how do we begin to combine both to think about this in a slightly different way? Now, once we begin to look at the mobile technology and the apps that are sitting on the phones, we have to begin to think about what are the challenges around that? What kind of issues do we run into? The biggest one is data. Right? This is a core challenge, mobile data. When you download and install an application to your phone, chances are you probably didn't pay anything for it. Right? It used to be that buying a piece of software meant going to a store like Best Buy and walking up and down an aisle and buying a cardboard box that was mostly air, and then you'd spend the afternoon trying to install it and updating your device drivers and everything else. But now you can find that app, install it, and find a coupon and apply it in the time it takes to order a burrito. And it was free, right? Chances are you probably paid more for your coffee this morning than you do for mobile apps. This is a new model for software. But data is another piece of that. It figures into the total cost of ownership for that app. The days of unlimited, all-you-can-eat data are basically over. Many of us have grandfathered it in for years. Our students were in diapers when unlimited data plans were available, right? They're coming in with the lowest data plans because that's what they can afford. Mobile data is a big issue, especially when we look at, okay, we're providing you your textbooks onto your mobile device, but guess what? You're going to have to pay for the bandwidth to consume them with. This is a new problem. Data can also compound for the institution itself. This gentleman here, I'm sure you've heard his song, seen his video, Gangnam Style, you know? 600 million views or something like that on YouTube. There was this interesting article in Forbes where they looked at, what does it cost YouTube to host this video? One video, right? And they estimated it costs around 300 grand for them to host the one video, right? In all of its forms. It comes in like a dozen different formats that YouTube encodes them into, right? This is one video. Now, it's a very extreme case, mind you. But it's getting at, once you make content available, and once you're providing something that consumes bandwidth, it's something that can grow very quickly, that can consume every available resource, right? So mobile data is something to think about, is that I may only have 250 megs in my quota this month, or I may only have a gig to consume with. How thrilled am I going to be about consuming my classroom recording with it? You know, something along those lines. Data is a big issue. We also have to kind of begin to rethink, not only from a data perspective, but from a content perspective, how do we package content? See, currently we package content essentially based on a course idea, that here's everything you would need to know on a particular topic, and we'll break it down by numerical chapter. But why do that? I mean, we now have the technology to do this differently, just like with the software, where we unbundled the software, where we could buy our functionality a la carte at a much lower price, why couldn't we do the same thing with content? That the content could be sold to the student based on what they actually use. I bet every one of us has bought a textbook. When we were in school, we bought a textbook that we never opened. Right? Anyone not? Oh, two or three people. Yeah. Chances are this has happened to everyone. So why shouldn't the student just pay for what they consume? Why shouldn't they be able to unbundle those books? Why shouldn't it be at a much lower cost? What that also creates is this diversity of ideas where you can begin to introduce new topics that weren't intended before. We had faculty teaching very advanced topics where there was no book on that subject, or there was only one paper or one small resource or parts of different books that needed to be combined. It was this new challenge, but it was a very expensive one. Because essentially you're licensing pieces of books as opposed to licensing individual ideas. See, that's what we see is this long tail of content right now. At one end, we have the common core material, your math, your core sciences, your history, your English, your communications, these kinds of things that every student takes. But then it trails off very quickly. This concept I call the Weekend at Bernie's principle. The Weekend at Bernie's principle basically states that every movie is somebody's favorite movie. And we know this is true because Weekend at Bernie's had a sequel. Actually, it had two of them. So somebody must have liked it. And if somebody liked Weekend at Bernie's, then there's a movie out there for everyone. Okay? Content works the same way. We have this long tail of ideas. That means that there's an idea out there for everyone. And we can begin to harvest these new ideas and begin to collect them as textbook replacements, as supplements to courseware, but we can begin to not only consume it, but create it. To write a book is to like build the pyramids. I don't want to build the pyramid. I just want to build this little piece. I just want to build this one thing that it turns out I might know something about. See, the idea of selling content, in the very near future, we will feel about buying textbooks the same way we would feel about buying encyclopedias today. There used to be a guy that would come to your door and sell you a set of encyclopedias. And people bought them. When was the last time you saw one of those people? Right? Nobody's buying encyclopedias anymore. This is the way content goes. It evolves over time. Now, once we get beyond this, once we have the content, once we're delivering it, what we next have to figure out is how to measure it. We're measuring two things. We can measure the effectiveness of the content itself, but then we can also measure the impact of its delivery. There are two pieces. Is the content useful, and is the manner of its delivery actually improving the learning process somehow? This is important. It brings about an idea we call Schrodinger's app. Schrodinger's app, right? It's an app that is both alive and dead. It's both successful and unsuccessful. In the absence of any data to suggest otherwise, it's both, right? Schrodinger's app. What we need to look for are the indicators. Things like the Waffle House Index. Are you familiar with the Waffle House Index? Do they have Waffle Houses in Colorado? Anybody know? I gave this talk in Canada. They don't have Waffle Houses there. They have Tim Hortons. I don't know. It was a whole other thing. Anyway, FEMA uses something called the Waffle House Index. This is a real thing. So what they do is that after a major storm or some kind of devastation, what they do is they look at the Waffle House in the area. And based on how it's operating, that can give them some indication of what's happening on the ground. So if the Waffle House is open and serving a full menu, how bad could it have been? Right? The Waffle House is open. But if Waffle House is closed, whoa, it must have been bad, right? It doesn't suggest anything about the level of devastation. It doesn't tell us what's actually happening, but it gives us very real insight into what's happening on the ground. It's an indicator, right? And what our content, our learning content can become is that indicator. What's happening on the ground? What's happening for your student as they're interacting with this content? What's happening as this content is impacting them as part of a kind of overall learning process, right? So these are the ideas, these were the things that we discovered at Purdue in our pursuit of what is the thing that exists beyond the book. Right? So we developed a new technology, and many of these ideals were things that we worked into that technology as a way to try and find our way through this process. Find our way through how do we actually improve this for our students, and how do we begin to lower the costs. And some things have worked and some things haven't. But I wanted to talk a little bit about project we conducted called Jetpack. Jetpack was an enabling technology that was designed to enable our faculty to develop and package content, right? And the content could be any number of things. It could have been a textbook replacement. In many classes it was. It could have been a way to share case material. It could have been a way to share supplemental instruction, right? It enabled a number of different approaches. But what it didn't do was it didn't become a book. It said, you know what? If we're going to distribute learning content, it takes all different forms. Some of it's video, some of it's documents, some of it's HTML5, these little mini apps, some of it's photos, some of it's podcasts. There are all these different forms of media, and to deliver them to a mobile device, each one had its own set of challenges. And so that's what the technology had to resolve. So this is how Jetpack works. Students are given a set of packs. They can access them, in this case, from their iPhone. They can dive into it. Some of it's very textual in nature. But what it does is it says, you know what? Not everything has to be a rectangle. Not everything has to be a page of content. Some things are just pictures. Some things are just videos. Students can make comments. They can take notes. They can interact with one another. In addition, they have these inline assessments that they can take, so they can begin to answer questions in real time to assess whether or not they know the material. But the intent was not to deliver them a series of rectangles to flip through linearly, but to provide a pack or a collection of content that they could drive into no matter how it was they wanted to interact with it. Now, to enable this, we created this web-based authoring tool. So our faculty could come in and they could collaboratively work to build out this content. Right? Because the idea of publishing should work less like actually setting type and more like blogging. Right? Most of us are familiar with that concept. It's the thing, whatever the content is, whatever the ideas I want to share, I can easily craft and deliver that. Right? So we developed a tool where they could author this content. All they had to do was bring it in and collect it together. And then Jetpack went through and it just kind of figured out what to do with it. So if you uploaded a video, it would put it in the necessary formats to work on the different devices. This kind of idea. Now what happened as a result was we saw a number of interesting things. First was we created a way for them to just kind of upload HTML5 based content. And this is from the Amelia Earhart archives at Purdue. So we could take this content that was already on hand, that the libraries already had in collection, and begin to deliver it in a newer interactive way. So it enabled the highest form of interactivity. So if you had the skills and you wanted to apply them, you could do it, right? Or you could create, like the pack I was showing you earlier, something much simpler. You didn't have to understand how the technology worked to do it. Again, it's designed to work like blogging. But anytime you start to talk about the inclusion of content or the publishing of content to students, one of the first challenges that comes up is copyrights, the specter of copyright, right? So what we did is we designed this around the idea of fair use. What if we could make the tool enable fair use, or what we describe create a safe environment for fair use, help our faculty understand what it means, and then help provide them a way to manage it? So they could identify, based on a video or a document or whatever it was that they had, they could identify it as material that they were using under fair use. And then what they could do is provide an expiration date for that content. And they could limit its distribution so only the students in their class could get it. They would download it to their devices. And then at the end of the semester or whenever the date hit, it would evaporate off of their phone. Right? It would be replaced by a citation. So I said, look, you didn't own this. It was only being used under fair use. If you'd like to secure this material, here's a link to the library. Here's a link to the collection. Here's a link to Amazon, whatever the case may be, so you can go secure that material. Now, like I said, the key part of this was to make it available across multiple different devices. And one of the interesting things we found about our students was that when we started to look at their mobile usage, the vast majority was covered on two platforms, right? iPhone and Android. Probably not that surprising. Well over 80%. Actually, that number is rising substantially now that BlackBerry is in decline. So what we did is we developed two apps, one for iOS, one for Android, but then by extension you get, you know, things like iPod Touch and iPad, Android tablets, and then also the Kindle Fire. We had some Kindle Fire programs going on campus at the same time. And really took advantage of the capabilities of those devices. For example, what it does is it actually downloads the content to the device. So you don't have to have an internet connection for it to work. And so the students just walk around all day, and so if they want to watch a movie, it's already there on their phone. They just tap on it and they play it. It works just like, you know, their iPod does. It has the music on it. I don't have to stream it down. The upside for them is they're not chewing through their data cap. The upside for the institution is I'm not streaming a video to 200 students' cell phones inside of the classroom. Right? It alleviates Wi-Fi issues that way. So we could do that just on a small number of devices, which was really kind of the opportunity. It wasn't about supporting endless numbers of devices. I mean, Android alone is several hundred devices. It was really looking at how do we meet lowest common denominator for our students. And it was a big part about understanding what our students are like. Now, in practical use, it's your two of our faculty. Jennifer Neville on the left there, she is a professor of computer science. She teaches on encryption. And at the level she teaches, there's no book for that, right? There are books on encryption, but most of them aren't, let's say, hard enough. They don't have the content that her course really needs. Really, she needed a collection of materials. And Dr. Jacob on the right, he was an author himself. He had written books that were no longer in print. Based on his agreement, he had his copyrights come back to him because he had no way to give them to his students, but he was writing new books. And he was able to independently negotiate with his publisher free access for his own students. See, that in itself is not a business model, but what it means is these faculty are now enabled with a platform to self-negotiate this for their own students. So as a result, the students in Dr. Neville's class saved over $100 per student because they didn't have to buy a textbook. That was an exciting class. They actually clapped. It was kind of cool. Dr. Jacob's class, over $400 per student. They didn't have to buy three different textbooks for 2 years, right? See, these were the things that we found that were interesting. We enabled these faculty to be creative about where they got their content from and how they used it. With Dr. Neville, she used things we already had. Chances are the library already has in their collection a license for you to use some body of content. It's just there for using. And what we need is an enabling technology to get it there. And so that's what we put into place, and it happened. It kind of created this ecosystem where the faculty could just be creative about using it. But then there was one that was really interesting. It was a professor in veterinary science, and she studies brain and spinal cord injuries. She's quite literally a brain surgeon. Right, but for animals. And she has this material that she uses that is, you know, it's just kind of different. It's things like MRIs, right? This is I believe to be a healthy dog brain, right? But what she can do is begin to now distribute this to her students, and they have that material, whether it's in the lab, whether it be actually in the clinic where they service the animals, whether they're doing their homework, they have access. This is timely material. Sure, you can get a dog MRI from a lot of different places, but you can't get a dog MRI from the dog that's down the hall, the one that you can actually go and touch and pet, right? My colleague Kevin O'Shea is sitting right there. He's working with his professor, and he goes into the clinic, and he got attacked by 12 golden retriever puppies. That's a good day when that happens, right? But this is the exciting part, was that she thought creatively about, I have this need to distribute content to my students. How do I get that done? And now we had a way to do it. And that was kind of the exciting part, was that once we enabled the faculty, they got creative about it. So that's really the underlying tone for my message today, is how can we move beyond ebooks? How can we rethink what a book is, and why are they still books? Why are we still subscribed to all of these notions of what content is or should be? How can we act creatively to mitigate some of these issues? How can we create an ecosystem where our faculty can be creative about how they solve these problems on their own? They don't want the students to pay more for their books than they have to. So we need to enable them in a different way. See, we're at this exciting period of time now where it is very much a period where we have achieved science fiction, right? We look at mobile devices like the iPad, and we revel in their simplicity, and we appreciate the advancement. But at the same time, we have to ask ourselves, is that the beginning of a revolution, or is it the end of one? You see, tools like the iPad were first foretold in the movies. First in the movie 2001, later more accurately depicted in Star Trek The Next Generation. Captain Picard used a device actually called a pad, which is fantastic when you consider that in the Star Trek universe, they had not yet found a cure for baldness, but tablets, that was a technology they had cracked. You see, this is our opportunity. As institutions, we can begin to place more smaller bets. We can take advantage of a new campus that's emerging, a new classroom that's emerging, a new classroom that exists in the social networking connections between students and on the phones in their pockets. This is what we can do, is create more simpler solutions that help get us there, that help our students learn. My name is Kyle Bowen. Thank you again for your time today. I can answer a few questions if anybody would like to. And once again, for the folks online, I'd love to hear what questions you have. But anyways, thank you very much for your time. Yes, please.
Kyle, would you then encourage faculty to create apps rather than create books if they're looking to put content out that would be monetized in some way?
Sure. So I guess there are two pieces to that, yes and no. So there are some things that lend themselves to being encompassed inside of an app. And so the real question is how is that material going to take advantage of the capabilities of the phone itself or the tablet itself? Because if it's just a means to distribute content, there are other tools that can do that. And so that's where, when we developed Jetpack, it was a way to say, okay, let's hybridize that concept. Let's say there's a mobile app that takes advantage of the capabilities of the device, but really is designed to deliver content and begin to collect analytics and really take advantage of what the device does, but not really with having to go through the mess of actually publishing the app. But sometimes an app is what makes sense. And we've done that before. We have an app we call Green Nose. We work with a faculty member who studies Costa Rican agriculture. And she had this need to develop an interactive experience where you'd actually spot a plant in Costa Rica and track that information over time, and it was really taking advantage of the device itself. So it made sense at that point for it to be an app. But certainly, I think that's the direction we begin to move. What other questions do we have? Yes, ma'am.
I was just curious about how has this impacted the kinds of projects that the students are doing?
Fantastic question. So we just started to see that this semester as we had, as part of students and their kind of digital storytelling, or as part of an explanation of a particular notion, they were developing packs themselves. So the tool, it became not the distribution tool, but it was essentially the homework environment. They were creating their own content. And the interesting part of that begins to happen when you have lower levels beginning to create content for higher levels. Other way around. Higher levels beginning to create content for the lower levels, or beginning to create content for online instruction. Right, so that's, again, creating that kind of open ecosystem where they can be creative about how they're doing that. And doing it in such a way that it doesn't create new problems, but actually solves some of the old ones we had before. That was the real trick of it. Yes, sir.
You mentioned HTML5 as pieces that could be included into a Jetpack. Do you have an example of that you could show us? I know you're at that final slide.
The Amelia Earhart piece I was showing you there had like the rich kind of layout and design and everything. That was an HTML5 based, so it was a custom, so there was a graphic designer actually designed that out and could publish it inside of the pack. And then it was adaptive to the whatever device it was running on. So if it was running on a phone, it would adapt itself to fit inside of that environment. We've also worked with very simple specialized calculators, things that we need to calculate out, and it's kind of atypical. So these would be things that would be simple one-page apps that would run inside of an environment that would do basic simulation. But at the same time, we've also had faculty who've used it to do social integration. So they want to bring in a Twitter feed. They want to bring in some YouTube videos. They want to bring in something that exists in another environment, a Tumblr feed or something like that. They use HTML5 as a mechanism to pull in that content from outside of their pack. Yes, over there. Okay, so two questions. One was, how big is my team? And then the other was, how are they authoring the content? Is that right? Oh, okay, good question. So how is the authoring interface developed? Okay, so my team, we have 15 people, but we're not, so actually this is our studio website, so if you want to learn any more about any of our other projects, Purdue.edu/studio. And so we have a kind of collection of projects that we work on, but we also provide services to the institution, content management, these kinds of things, also like web development. So it's not to say that 15 people like we're focused on this one thing. Generally, it's a team of three or four. The apps themselves are custom built. They're all developed in .NET and C#, and then the native apps are then developed in their native platforms, so Objective-C and Java and for Android. Yes.
Two related questions. You mentioned that you are able to hit between Android and iOS 80, let's call it 90 to be generous, percent of mobile users. What about the 10% who either aren't on those platforms or aren't mobile users at all? How do they consume the content?
Excellent question. So earlier when I was talking about having a hybrid approach, a mobile plus web strategy, so all of the content that gets distributed to the devices is also available online. And so any notes or comments or conversations that happen on mobile devices, wherever, they get synchronized across the environments. So, and that's an excellent point, is to make sure that, you know, the students who don't have these technologies, or accessibility also becomes a concern then, because not all technologies may be accessible to the students, that it's available to all, and that students aren't disenfranchised through, you know, this adoption of new technologies. That's an excellent question, and it's one that, like I said, a mobile plus web approach is one that is really prudent.
Actually answers my second question, which was how do you avoid privileging those students, and that's perfect. You got it. Nailed. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. So right now it's a very simple process. So they can there's kind of a short messaging function inside of the tool. So based on any particular piece of media, the students can engage in a conversation just on that. So on this video or on this document or on this image or page or whatever it might be, they can you know, ask a question, or they can engage with the other students or anyone else who's consuming the same material, because sometimes that's across courses at the same time, and then. Also, they can take notes, independent notes on different material pieces. That's where also faculty have been. So using HTML5 as a way to be extensible on these platforms makes possible for whatever the instructor is using as the place where their conversation is happening for their class. They can begin to kind of bring that in, and it becomes a part of a conversation that's in context now. So rather than being, hey, go to these five different locations, we now have, okay, you have this pack on your phone that provides you those different locations in one place. And then also, we use Blackboard Learn, and so we include that as also a conversational element, and we use the Blackboard Learn API to deliver access to that material from that environment as well. Yes, ma'am.
Just a quick reminder that we use the microphones on the sides of the room so that our online audience can participate. Thanks.
Go ahead, I'll repeat your question. Okay, so two questions. Who owns the content? And the second question is, what happens at the end of the semester? So the first question is content ownership is pursuant to our institutional policy on content ownership. So generally, the faculty own their content. Base is kind of the base response to that. What happens at the end of the semester differs based on the nature of the material. So it only disappears or kind of evaporates if it's content that they don't own. Okay, so this is content that they just cannot continue to maintain over time. But at no time does the student's content disappear. So any notes or questions or any interaction that has happened on that content is theirs. It's there theoretically indefinitely. Right? It's theirs to access. It's just the content itself isn't there anymore. And it's been replaced by a citation. So now they have the conversation, and then they have a means by which to consume it. Things that they do own, or that the student does own, either explicitly or implicitly own, persists, you know, until they delete it, pretty much. It just exists on their device. They have persistent access to it through a web interface. So it's really based on the nature of the content in terms of what happens to it at the end of the semester.
I guess
Sure. So so the question is about how do we maintain the archives of this content? And in reality, the system we built itself was the archive. So over time, it managed the pedigree of that content. So as it evolved over time, we had kind of the previous, and we could track that back. It could be split off and used in different by different instructors in different courses, these kinds of things. Yes, sir.
So the topic of my question is really around effort. Okay, the effort to create or aggregate content, right? So when I think about the course material used for college courses, core material traditionally and even today is a textbook. And for the most case, you know, faculty really aren't authors of core course material. Mm-hmm. They may aggregate course packs and pull out journal articles, but you know, it takes a lot of effort to write course materials or even to aggregate it. Like, I want to blog, but I just can't find the time or the effort to do that.
Sure.
And when it comes to adoption of new methods of consuming content, it really is that critical mass of content that matters. Because I may be taking one course in Jetpack, one course I'm reading a Course Smart ebook, and then for the other two courses I have a print textbook. So really I'm like sort of all over the board with how I'm consuming my content. And it kind of goes back to who's going to create the content? Are we going to expect rank and file faculty folks to be spending the time to go in and create these works when the publisher is spending millions of dollars creating the content and the quizzes and the PowerPoints, and I can focus on research and still deliver a quality education in the classroom without jetpacking, right?
Sure.
So that's where I'm trying to wrap my mind around is at the end of the day, really what it all comes down to is the content there and how difficult is it to pull it together in a way that matters?
Sure. So this is an excellent question. So part of it is, so every instructor is going to approach it differently. But the fundamental truth is this. Everyone who teaches, and it doesn't matter what they teach, creates content, right? It may not be the course textbook, but they create content of some form. Just as a manner of teaching their course. Now, some create more than others. Some actually do write their textbooks, but it's a very small percentage. Some create course packs. Some maintain a blog. This content gets created in a wide variety of different ways. And so what we looked at was, how can we enable those who don't publish textbooks formally to begin to informally create material? So that, for example, we have a professor who, you know, the idea of writing a textbook or writing a book or writing all of the content for a course in itself is fairly onerous. So why do you have to do it all at once? So if we looked at kind of that problem of packaging the content, if we packaged it topically, we could do it over time. And then what she did was she actually went out and worked with her colleagues to peel off different pieces of that. And so they worked together. And so really the end result is, you're right, that's a base problem of where do you get the content from. And it's kind of what I was talking about with the long tail. You know, there are going to be the content stores for, you know, algebra. You know, throw a rock, you're going to hit an algebra book, right? But where are the ones for the, you know, low-level encryption, these kinds of things that don't have masses of books or needs very timely information? The professor that needed MRIs, x-rays, and lab notes from an animal that's down the hall, what's the means she uses to publish with? And so it's really beginning to think about differently about what is the content that we use in our courses as opposed to just another way to ship the book. And so that's where what you're asking is a very good question. And part of it is what we're saying is, well, let's change the model or the paradigm such that it doesn't work that way anymore, such that it's more free form, that things aren't just fixed rectangles anymore. Yes, sir.
Do you have plans to license Jetpack?
Oh, excellent question. So, yeah, fortunately, what we've done is we've partnered with a company called Skypack, and it's a commercial endeavor, and there's a freemium model. And so there's a beta available right now. Actually, in the startup alley upstairs, you can stop by and see them and get a little beta card. It's the same technology, so what we did is we licensed it out so that other people could use it. And so you could, yeah, if you stop by startup alley, you get a little beta code and start using it here soon. In the back.
Are you thinking of putting on a PDF and not a textbook? Or
Great question. So the question is how are we helping ensure accessibility of the content? You know, and this is just kind of the universal challenge of instructional content is how do we ensure its access? So for content that's authored inside of the tool, we do a number of steps to try and lead faculty towards making it accessible, doing things like requiring descriptions on images or helping identify, okay, you're sharing this video here and it has no transcript. Because many times, not making it accessible wasn't an intentional choice, it was just they didn't know. And so what we tried to do was make it so that it would help them down that path. Now, does that help us resolve issues like the inaccessible PDFs? You know, that's a much more complex problem. So it doesn't make it any worse, but it's an attempt to try and make it better by leading faculty down that path. And that's kind of a part of what we envisioned about it was, okay, how can these more free-form types of content, how can we begin to assess the accessibility of that content as well? So it's got to be more than just making the environment accessible. It's got to be how can we help the faculty make their content accessible and do that as a component of creation. So that's the overall goal. Is that all the questions? Do we have any questions in the back channel or online or anything like that? Okay, yeah. Yeah. If you're online, you can go to skypack.com, skyepack.com, and you can go there. Any other questions? Good. Anyways, thank you very much for your time. You guys are great. Thank you.